them on instinctively.
Well, I know it's. I kind of prefer to have them on, even though it serves no purpose.
Feel, no, I know it makes you feel like you broke off.
It serves no purpose whatsoever. Mark Commode, it's lovely to see you. We were just saying, I met you about 8 years ago
when
I was promoting, rather pointlessly because no one watched it, the breakfast show Rise, which was a fun year, paid me very, very well, no bugosaurus at all.
Right.
And I suspect I may have been a cocky young buck, because at that point I believed I was the king of the world. If I was rude to you in any way, Mark Commode, I apologise.
I tell you, if you were rude to me in any way, I didn't notice.
That's...
Nor do I. I'm sure that you were, you know, charm itself.
I think...
You have, fantastically, I'm pleased to say,
yep.
You have gone a little grey. Which is great, no, because I'm turning into Silver Fox.
You're lighter than I was expecting you to be, yes.
Yeah. I'm but it's happening really fast.
Really?
Like in the last 6 months,
yeah.
I mean, I'm going profoundly grey. I used to have like a, you know, Dickie Davis,
yeah,
a little bit there, but it's going.
Yeah.
What I'm aiming for is, you know, Nick Lowe, the great.
Of course, player, yes.
Completely silver quick.
I'm aiming for David Byrne, completely white with a side parting. That's
very
that's where I'm going.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good look.
And I'm embracing the greyness. A lot of people say, oh, Jimmy Carr dyes his hair, for example. I remember seeing Jimmy Carr one day, he was grey, the next day he had jet black hair. And I thought, well, that's not. And he said, well, I do it so that the young people like me. But that's pointless, isn't it? It's a silly game to play.
Well, this is the colour of my hair. I'm very, very fond of it going grey because, it, you know, because I said, I think Nick Lowe is an icon of cool, and his hair was completely. I was watching the television the other day, and there was that Elton John thing on, and of course Elton John now has got the full cat sitting on his head, and they showed some sort of historical footage of him in the 1970s,
yeah,
and a bald Zacou.
Yeah, of course.
Isn't it weird? You know, he must look back on footage of himself with no hair.
Now,
now
he
has the kind of the page boy thing.
Is it a syrup or did he had plugs or something, didn't he? Yeah. Yeah. It's a strange thing to do. I had a friend who went bald at 20. We'll talk about you in a minute. Sorry, I just realised I'm going off on a tangent. I had a friend who went bald at 20 and he embraced it and it works perfectly, you know, and he's completely bald. And
there was a guy who used to walk, I was in Manchester for about 6 years, and there was a guy who used to walk up and down Market Street in Manchester wearing a really old grey drape coat, and on the back of it, in studs, was the phrase "clapped out old Ted." And he had, like, literally three strands of hair, one on either side and one in the middle, that he greased back, and they met at the back in a cartoon diagram of what a DA would look like if you had hair, and he looked magnificent.
Fantastic.
I just thought, that's the way to go.
Have you seen any good films recently?
I've just seen Jackass 3D.
You were telling me about this. It sounds hideous.
I'm 47.
Yeah. Right?
So when I was, going to see alternative cinema, you know, at late night screenings, you know, Phoenix in East Finchley, that kind of thing, they would show the John Waters movies.
Mm.
And the John Waters movies, there would be, like, the most outrageous moment would be when Divine ate poo.
Yes.
Right? You know,
I've never seen it, but I've heard of it. No, yes, I'm aware of it.
Well, the Jackass 3D, it's kind of like that for 90 minutes in 3D. And I mean, I understand that tastes change, but after the bit when the guy is in a bungee, they've got a portable toilet,
yeah,
full of poo.
Lovely.
And they bungee the portable toilet up into the air so that all the poo comes out of the toilet.
Okay.
And then everyone throws up.
In 3D.
I mean, it's in 3D.
Do you need the third dimension?
Well,
for that,
you know, I have to tell you that you know how I feel about 3D. So, but frankly, I think that's probably what it was designed for. You know, it was designed for people being sick.
I saw something in 4D.
Yeah, you mean at a theme park or something?
Well, yeah, and the fourth dimension is spray.
Yeah.
Apparently, that's it.
Well, no, there's if you go to like Universal, there's Shrek 4D at Universal, in which there's wind is blown at you, there's rain,
right?
There's stuff.
This was at the London Eye, so not quite so impressive. A little bit of spray.
But they've got, like, you know, interested, because that goes back to William Castle, where,
right,
he used to do things like Percepto, and he would wire up the seats.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
Electrical charge, and then they have skeletons flying over the audience and that,
yeah,
sort of thing. But, I mean, that's fine. That's all sort of carnival showmanship. I don't believe that 3D is the future of cinema. I certainly don't believe all this stuff about, oh, it's an immersive dimension. No, it's not. It's a carnival sideshow gimmick. That's,
yeah, fine. Very much so. And a lot of the films that are coming out in 3D are crap and only getting audiences because of the 3D, that's it.
Yeah, and an awful lot of films are coming out now not in 3D because people like Christopher Nolan realise that 3D is a total waste of time. I mean, Christopher Nolan recently said he's not making the new Batman movie in 3D. Of course, he made Inception in 2D, very behind the IMAX format. You know, I think, and I've said this very publicly, you give it 3 years, 3D is back exactly where it was before.
But this is what they do every 20 years. Oh, 3D! And then it disappears, and then,
yeah,
20 years later, 3D!
20-year cycle,
yeah.
Because the last cycle before this was Friday the 13th, Part 3, Amityville 3D,
yep.
Jaws 3D. And then before that, you go back to House of Wax, you know, Dial M and all those sort of things. Before that, back to Warner Devil. In fact, they were making 3D movies back, you know, 1902, 1903. And every now and then somebody reels it out and everyone goes, oh, that's really quite interesting. It was very quick.
I remember seeing the Friday the 13th. There was a Halloween, not Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street in 3D, I think.
Yeah, there was, in the final section of the final Nightmare on Elm Street, there's a bit when he goes to hell.
Yeah.
And, is that Jason goes to hell? There was one movie in which the last bit you put the 3D glasses on, it was rubbish.
I remember watching it at college with 20 other people and we're going, right, pass it round. And that, we had one pair of glasses between the lot of them. Now, I saw you a couple of weeks ago at a screening. I was having a particularly bad day, so I didn't come and
say hello.
No, I didn't say hello. I was having a terrible day. I'll tell you off mic. But it was awful. But it was for Red.
Oh, yeah.
Now, apart from the bit where Bruce Willis steps out of the car and the police car spins around behind him, I thought it was awful.
Did you?
I thought it was pretty lousy. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I thought it was quite fun. I mean, the thing about it was I didn't have great expectations for it. And the bit that you're talking about is the one bit that I kind of could have lived without.
Oh, I love that.
Well, it's fine. Yeah. You know, it's a little bit of a special effect.
Yeah.
What I quite liked was the fact of a bunch of old codgers doing the old codgers. I mean, I don't think it's any masterpiece by any means. But it was passingly entertaining because it had that, you know, that idea. I mean, funnily enough, Warren Ellis wrote a piece in The Guardian about movies about old farts basically ganging up. And he wrote at the end of it, he said, you know, all you people who are out there playing computer games, your parents are in cinemas watching films about people of their age beating people of your age up. That was kind of what it was about. I mean, I don't think it's anything to write home about, but I thought...
Oh, OK, well, you've caught me off guard then, because I was going to say that I was supposed to go and interview Bruce Willis the next day, who I'm a huge fan of. I think
you didn't go because you hated the film?
Well, I didn't go because of stuff that was happening, but I'm glad I didn't go, because I wouldn't have known... I've not done many junkets, those things where you get five minutes in a hotel room. How do you interview someone when you think their film is a stinker?
Well, you have to tell them.
Really?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I'm in a very lucky position because I've been doing the radio show with Simon Mayer for a very long time now. And actually, we don't generally have to interview anyone we don't want to interview. So if the guest comes up, you get asked, you know, what's he in that? Occasionally, what will happen is, if I really don't like a film, but Simon really does, then we can have a guest in and then we can have a sort of sensible debate about it.
Yeah.
If we both don't really like it, there's really no point in getting somebody in just to say your film sucks.
Mm.
There's the door. What I do think, however, is that what you should never do is to lie to somebody about it. Because, you know, that whole thing about, oh, I loved your movie, tell me all about it, then the minute they're gone, you have to go. Because in the end, they're going to hear you.
Of course.
And you might as well say it to somebody's face. I do think this, if you can't say it to somebody's face, you shouldn't say it. If you do say it, you should be able
to... That takes balls, though, doesn't it, to say to someone like Bruce Willis, didn't really think the film was much good.
I don't know if it would get you very far. Certainly not in the case of those junket interviews. But, I mean, you know, my greatest memory of this was...
Oh, yes, we're here to plug the book. We'll mention that in a second.
But just apropos of that, I had been quite rude about the Queen, you know, for which Helen Mirren
won
the best actress, everything, you know, Oscar, BAFTA,
blah, 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 blah.
And I thought that it wasn't, I mean, I thought it was very well acted, but I thought it was a TV film,
not
a film. I do think there's a big difference between television and cinema. And I'd said, this isn't a film, it's a TV movie. And I'd said it in a lot of places because I did feel it quite strongly. And then I was at the BAFTAs the year that Helen Mirren was obviously going on to win. Everybody knew she was going to win. Mm. Everybody knew in advance because she was, you know, it was such a great performance by her. And I've never met Helen Mirren before. And I just thought, sure, she didn't know me from a hole in the ground. And at the BAFTAs, she came and she handbagged me. She came up to me, she put me on the shoulder. She said, what do you mean it's not a real film? And I said, right, and there was, and it was one of those moments when you thought, okay, well, now, look, you can't say you didn't say it.
No.
Because clearly she's heard you.
Yeah, you've got to embrace it.
You can't say you didn't mean it, because that's worse, right? That's, I didn't mean, that's just wrong. And you can't run away, because there's a bunch of television cameras, and everyone's looking at Helen Mirren, and everybody is noticing that Helen Mirren is giving you a hard time. So what happened was, I started to explain myself to her, as I felt, you know, like, okay, in the moments where you have to explain yourself. So I started explaining myself, and I was...
I'm getting uncomfortable even listening to this. It sounds horrible.
I started saying, well, what I meant was that there's a difference between television and cinema, television, intimate experience, cinema, theatrical experience, you know, group, da, 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 da. And I started to, which was fine, from the neck upwards, I was great. Unfortunately, what happened was, it quite involuntarily, I began to bend at the knee. And literally, as I was explaining myself, I sank down until I was like down on one knee in front of Helen Mirren, explaining what I meant when I said it wasn't a real movie.
And how did she respond? I bet she was lovely, wasn't she?
I mean, by that point, she'd won.
Yeah.
I mean, I explained it, but I had knelt down in front of her. And then, she, it was like one of the, she obviously had read the stuff, because she then said to me, not everything can be Pan's Labyrinth.
Right.
And I thought, blimey, you've done your homework.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, but fair enough. But I do think if you can say it about somebody's work, you have to be able to say it to their face. And if you can't, then don't.
Listen, you've mentioned the book. It's only a movie. I like this. Was this your ego getting this cover with you mixed with the Terminator? Did you go in and say, this is what I want, goddammit?
Yes.
Excellent stuff.
The first Gazette.
The one I've got is you eating popcorn in the cinema.
With a chainsaw.
Right.
The first one, I said, well, I want a big thing of popcorn and a chainsaw, right? And the publishers were lovely. They said, oh, they got a chainsaw. I went, no, a big chainsaw. And they got another one. I said, no, a big chainsaw. And they got another one. I went, no, look, for heaven's sake, you've seen Texas 2, right? A big chainsaw. The chainsaw they got for the film was finally so big that it turned up with a guy who had to be with it at all times because it was the biggest chainsaw in the UK.
Fantastic.
And then for the paperback edition, which we've just done, I said, well, I really want to be the Terminator. So, but obviously...
I really want to be the Terminator. Did you write this? Did you write this yourself, didn't you? You didn't have a ghostwriter.
Does it read like I had a ghostwriter?
No, it doesn't. But I'm so naive about these things. Well, I can't remember who it was. I was interviewing someone and they said, oh, no, it was someone wrote it for me.
Yeah.
And I was gutted.
I hear that's the case. I hear that there are some film critics who don't watch movies.
I've heard this.
I hear there are some people who write newspaper columns that they dictate down the phone. I wrote
well
every
done.
Word. I'm a journalist. That's what
I
do.
When I saw you downstairs tapping away on your laptop, I thought, no, this man has definitely written a book.
No, but also, believe me, if you had a ghostwriter, it would have been written better.
Oh no! I think it's a cracking book, though. It's a cracking read. You skip over. You first came to my prominence. You skipped over with every good reason, I suppose.
I skipped over meeting you. Is that the
I'm not in it. Every book by someone I've ever met, I go straight to the index. No, I first saw you as the band on the Danny Baker show,
yeah.
Which was fantastic and terribly overlooked show as well. Which
yeah, it was great fun. I had met Danny on Radio 5. And I was the film critic on Radio 5. And I was in a skiffle. I played in skiffle bands all my life. That's the first skiffle band I was in was when I was six. And I was in this band in Manchester called the Railtown Bottlers, who were briefly big on the skiffle circuit. Played the London Palladium, won the international
standards.
Wow. Just outside your studio.
Yeah.
Out here, just out. In
you flicked. So you played the London Palladium. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I like to say big on the skiffle circuit. How big is that skiffle circuit? Yes, I thought maybe.
So we did that, and then Danny had this TV show that he was putting together, which I thought was a really great idea. And he said, "I want a house band. So do you want to do it?" Because he'd seen us play a couple of times. So we said, yeah, okay, fine, but the condition of it is that whoever the guests are that come on, they have to play with us as a sort of skiffle lineup, meaning, you know, double bass and washboard. And we had some great guests. I mean, it was the first person who came on was Suggs, who was brilliant. Danny's other condition was they had to play one song of their own choice.
And one Beatles song. Yes, that was it, of course. Yeah, yeah, I loved it.
And it was, you know, it was really, really good fun, and we really enjoyed it. And of course, you know, I learned an awful lot from working with Danny on the radio, because I still think Danny's like one of the, you know,
my entire act is stolen from Danny Baker, and I will say that openly. It's you know
I
it's...
think you're not alone in
that. Oh,
you know?
I admit it, but I was on the second series, which I don't think you were on.
No, just the first series.
There's a very tiny clip, and it's on YouTube, where what was brilliant about his show, and you could see it from watching at home, but being in the studio audience, is he quite often didn't know what to do next. And at the end, he said, right, we have no ending, because I think that they had a guest that wasn't very good. We've got no ending. We've got a drum kit. Can anyone play the drums? I went, yeah, I can. And I couldn't. And he said, well, what's your name, Ian? All right, well, come on then. So to the end of the show, we've got a bloke called Ian playing some drums. And I just went down and played the drums. And that was my big break.
There are quite a few bits of that show on YouTube. The reason I didn't talk about it in this book is because I'm doing another book now about what's wrong with cinema and how you can make it right. And the book I'm writing after that is about bands and being... So actually, the reason I haven't done it in that is because I want it for the third book. But there's a lot of YouTube stuff of the musical things from the Danny Baker show, the thing with Tim Finn and the thing with the guys from Squeeze. There is somewhere on YouTube the footage of us playing all the day and all the night with Lloyd Grossman.
Oh, really?
Lloyd Grossman turned up with a Fender.
He's in a punk band now.
Well, he was in what he referred to as a garage band.
A garage.
He was in a garage band. We were in garage bands. He was in a garage band. And we played all the day and all the night with it's funny, you see it on YouTube, people write underneath, is that film critic bloke from Mass?
He's quite a good guitarist.
Oh, yeah. No, he really was in a garage band when he was a kid.
Yeah.
It's
a brilliant series, and I keep trying to find hooky versions of it online to download, but they're not up anywhere, apart from the little clips on the YouTube.
I think that's it. Well, maybe somebody should release it as a DVD box set.
Oh, I think it should do. Anyway, listen, so the book, it's only a movie. Okay, let's ask, what's the worst movie you've ever seen? Can you quantify that? Is there one? Go on.
Okay, well, the worst movie ever made is Exorcist II, The Heretic. The most incompetent movie ever made is Oversexed Rugsuckers from Mars. And the reason that you have to differentiate between those two is that on a technical level, Oversexed Rugsuckers from Mars is unreleasably terrible.
Yeah.
And people say, oh, I saw that Jurassic Park, that's the worst film I ever saw. And you go, no, but come to my house, I'll show you the worst film you ever saw. The thing with Exorcist 2, The Heretic, is it's a film that had millions of dollars. Richard Burton, John Borman,
yeah.
You know, I mean, proper, you know, proper big, and was the stupidest thing I've ever seen.
You've 14 minutes in, you've mentioned The Exorcist. I'm going to go with it. I didn't like The Exorcist. Well, I think part of the reason I didn't like it is because of the hype. And I bought it on a hooky VHS in Camden when it was still banned. Oh, I think you could be right. And I was expecting more, because I also, the week before, I bought Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which I loved.
The funny thing about Texas Chainsaw Massacre is one of those films that actually, on grainy video, almost looks better.
I think you're right, yeah.
It looks more like a almost like a documentary.
Yeah.
In the case of Exorcist, although people talk about it all the time as a horror film, actually, it's a very, very, and I'm, without wanting to sound sort of precious about this, it's a very avant-garde movie. There is a lot of very surreal stuff happening in it, the dream sequence, and particularly the soundscape. Buzz Newton did the sound. It's got an extraordinarily avant-garde sound. Now, when those hooky videotapes you're talking about came out, because obviously it was outlawed under the video act for quite a long time, the sound was the thing that suffered.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how if you watch that movie with a bad sound, it doesn't work.
Right.
I mean, it simply doesn't work.
Yeah.
If you listen to a great version of the sound with the picture off, it does work. So much of what's going on in that film. I mean, for example, Ron Nagel, who was one of the guys who worked on the sound effects, did this thing. He was trying to get background noises during the possession scenes that would, you know, that would somehow get under the audience's skin. So he did all these things, like he would get a jar of wasps and shake them up and record the angry buzzing of wasps and then slow the sound down.
See, that's genius.
It is. He would go to, like, you know, abattoirs where there was, you know, animals being slaughtered, and he would record the sound, that he would mix in. And then Mercedes McCambridge, of course, did the voice of the demon. You know, it was extraordinary. She was the person who Orson Welles referred to as, you know, the greatest radio actress of her generation. That's all on the soundtrack.
Yeah.
If you take that away by watching, as you know, even proper VHS was never very good.
Yeah.
It's not great. The new, it's just come out recently on Blu-ray, and the sound is really so important to the film.
They've put a couple of your documentary on there, haven't they?
There's a documentary. The first documentary I ever made for the BBC was back in 1998. I made The Fear of God, which was a documentary about The Exorcist, because I'd written a book about it. And I had said that there was all these missing scenes that Bill Blatty, who was the author, wanted put back in again, and Friedkin said, well, they don't exist. And somehow I'd managed to inveigle my way into the studio's confidence. I said, well, you know, I'll go and pull them out. So we did. So we got the Spider Walk.
Fantastic.
And that went out in the documentary on the BBC in 98, and then that ended up on the DVD. And I think it's
that must be kind of cool for you
I'm really pleased with it, because it's given the thing a life, you know, because it means, because usually you make a documentary and it goes around once. I mean, I made a documentary about Blade Runner, about Wicker Man, about Alien. Actually, the Alien one has just come out on the Blu-ray thing. It means all the stuff that you did from years ago is all coming out again. So, but it's nice if it's on those things, because it means that, you know, it gives it a bit of life, because you spend a lot of time doing them. You know, they take quite a long time to make.
I saw Alien for the first time about 2 months ago.
You hadn't seen it before?
No, I hadn't. I'm 37. I remember taping it when it was on the telly in the mid-80s on a Betamax, and it didn't record. And I kind of gave up then. It was all right. I was a bit disappointed. I quite liked 3.
I quite like 4.
I've not seen 4 yet. And I was.
Well, I did this documentary about the whole series, and 4, which is the Jean-Pierre Jeunet one, which is the one which is pretty much universally reviled. 3 is a mess. Fincher pretty much disowned it.
Yeah.
It was recut. You know, he fought the studio all the way through. And then later on, when the studio went back to him and said, would you like to fix it? He effectively said, no, you know, you should have let me do it the first time around.
I quite liked
it,
though.
You know, there are things in 3 that you can see the film it could have been.
Yeah.
And in fact, on this new Blu-ray set, there's quite extensive behind the scenes, and quite honest behind the scenes, accounts of all the fighting that went. It was a horribly unhappy production. I mean, nobody was happy with it at all in the end. The first Alien I saw at the Gaumont in North Finchley, and I knew nothing about it other than that the publicity said it was The Exorcist meets 2001. I thought,
you're in.
Yeah, I'm in. And I knew nothing about the chest bursting scene. And all I knew was that it was this stylish one. I remember going to sitting there watching it, having no idea what was happening with the facehugger, and the chest burster scene, without knowing about it, was mind-bendingly scary. Now everyone knows that.
Yeah, exactly, and you know it's coming. And the actors didn't know that was going to happen.
Well,
is that true?
That's a half truth. I mean, they knew that something was going to happen. I mean, as Ridley Scott says, when I made this documentary, he said, "Look, they came into the room, right? the sound crew were all wearing Macs.
Gives away something.
They knew something. What they didn't know was how much sort of, you know, offal was going to come out of the chest cavity. And of course, it hit one of the actresses square in the face.
Yeah.
That reaction of her screaming, Veronica Cartwright, even screaming, is... is genuine.
Are there any gaps in your film history where films you've not seen? Like I hadn't seen Con Air until a couple of weeks. I've just had a baby. I had a baby about 9 months ago. Thank you very much, and it's wonderful. But it means that I'm Sky Plusing stuff, and at the weekends I get up at 5 o'clock, and I just watch all these crap films while I'm doing his breakfast and stuff like that. So I saw Con Air for the first time. I saw Die Hard 3 for the first time, which is an amazing film.
What's really funny is when you started that question.
Yeah.
There's a game that academics play, which is like a game of chicken, which is, admit, like for example, my wife's a professor of English and film, right? And it's a kind of chicken game, which is fess up to the most important book you haven't read,
yeah,
right? So you get somebody teaching an A-level course in Jane Austen, turns out they've never read Emma, right?
Yeah.
When you started that question, are there any gaps in your knowledge? I was thinking about Battleship Potemkin, Citizen Kane, Birth of Nation, and you go, because I saw Con Air.
But these are the circles I'm moving. I mention it. And you've never seen Con Air.
I wouldn't have thought of that as a gap in somebody's knowledge.
It's a classic, though, isn't it? It's a great movie.
It's all right. It's Michael Bay's lot. You know, I mean, it is what it is.
Oh, but it's load of prisoners on a plane, and it goes horribly wrong.
I know the film.
Okay.
I mean, you can tell me. I mean, I know what it is.
It's like The Rock. Guns, you know, explosions. Yeah. I've not seen The Rock. I've heard it's very good. Okay, are there any gaps in your film history? And you can pick your fancy foreign ones if you want.
Well, that's interesting. Is there any? I've never seen. I have actually. I was going to say I hadn't seen the long version of Heaven's Gate, because I have seen the long version of Heaven's Gate. In fact, I saw the long version of Heaven's Gate before I saw the short version. It was rubbish. I'm sure there are massive gaps, but off the top of my head, I can't think what they are. Because generally what would happen now is if somebody said to you, have you seen that film, and you hadn't, you just go to, you know, the local, and you buy it.
Yeah.
Because now you can get, when I was a kid, if you hadn't seen a Cronenberg film or a Lynch film, you had to just scan the listings of Time Out magazine to see what it was coming up. And actually, now you can just go to the shop and buy it.
I know exactly what you mean. I envy those days. Kids have it too easy because you can just download it, you can go and get it for £3. And it was a thing
they don't.
Exactly. And it was, if something came on, you know, when there were three channels, if something came on, BBC One on a Saturday at 10 o'clock, it was a big deal. But now everything, and you can get all the extended versions, you can get all the different, there's
no
something missing
now.
Yeah.
I remember this thing about Short Night of Glass Dolls played one Wednesday afternoon in Baker Street as the second feature to something else, and people bunking off school to go and see it because, you know, Aldo Lodden wasn't, those films weren't going to be playing locally. So that's what you did. There was a sense of urgency about it, and it'd be like a Friday night. You were really tired, but it just happened that they were showing the early Cronenbergs at the feature. You'd go to see them. Well, now everything's available.
I'm about to go through it. Are you aware of the phenomenon of Bruceploitation, Bruce Lee rip-off movies from the 70s and 80s, where it's lots of people called Bruce Le, okay. Bruce Lee, blah, anyway. And I've just read a little bit of a book about it. And I emailed someone and said, oh, I want to get some of these Bruce Lee rip-off films. He said, well, you can buy them from this website, or here's some links to them on YouTube. And suddenly I've got 20 links of these movies. And it's like, it's too easy.
Yeah.
It's too easy. I like the hunt. I like the chasing them down.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the funny things, when I was doing that Exorcist documentary, we trawled through everything that was in existence, pretty much. And we found, you know, outtake stuff. There was Owen Roisman's footage, which we weren't able to use, but which recently came up on the Blu-ray. And we were trying to find some early footage of Linda Blair, because she had been in some... she'd done some commercials and some TV stuff before she made Exorcist, which was kind of widely not spoken about because people didn't want to see her in any other than that. The other day, just completely coincidentally, I went to YouTube, and I went, YouTube, Linda Blair Exorcist. Everything.
It's all up there.
Every inch of missing... I mean, I imagine that the missing bits of the Watergate tapes are on YouTube.
More than likely. And now listen, you're what's this tour you're doing? A bit of stand-up comedy.
Yeah, but what's great about it is, again, the way... What is this tour?
What is this tour you're doing, Commode?
Inconceivable. Well, basically, what it is when people write books, what they often do is they go out and they do readings from the books, yes? Well, I can't do readings. I can't read out loud.
Right.
I literally can't. And so when I wrote the book, I tried to write the book to read like the way I talk, because I'd written books before, like the Exorcist book and the Shawshank book, which were for the British Film Institute, and they were sort of rather more academic. I was trying to write that like the way I talk. So When it came to, you know, do you want to go out and, you know, do some readings? I said, no, I don't want to do readings. What I'd like to do is just do an hour of telling stories from the book and then half an hour taking questions from the audience. And it's much closer to stand-up comedy than it is to a reading. I mean, I've just done one recently just at the Barbican, and I think we're doing 10, 11 dates around the country. And it's basically, I just, you know, I go on stage, I don't have a script or anything, and I just talk, I tell stories about things that have happened, many of which are in the book, some of which aren't. And it's, you know, meant to be funny and entertaining, and then people can ask whatever they want. And actually, from my point of view, it's the people asking questions that is the most interesting thing, because people are really interested in cinema. People come up with the weirdest things. Last night, somebody said, the last question of the evening, right, which is usually something. So last question of the evening was, what do you think about the rise of explicitly theological movies in the Hollywood mainstream having an effect on religious education in...
My next question. That was my next question. Exactly. Yeah, I was going with that.
And I said, well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I haven't had a chance. But it was nice. You know, I talked about Shawshank, and, you know, and it was written, but it wasn't something I'd thought about.
You have a lot of affection as well. To distill, you know, you're a film critic. I know there's other things, but you have a lot of affection. When I mentioned that you were coming on the show, I tweeted it and Facebooked it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, oh, yes. Loads of people. Oh, fantastic. You know, nice. So people love you and they like... your honestness, I think, honesty about the films.
Well, I think some people do. I mean, I'm not universally liked.
No one said, well, you've got that tosser coming on, which quite often we do get.
I'll tell you what, if you ever got half an hour free, Google Mark Kermode tosser and you just...
Really?
Yeah. The thing I was most proud of...
Bless you.
No, I think I've got no problem with this at all. I think it's very important. Actually, people often say to me, do you ever meet the people whose movies you slag off? Honestly... the only thing I ever find hard to understand is why people not having a sense of humour about their own work,
yeah,
and people being cross when you slag the face. Like, yeah, you know, grow up. But the best thing, you know, people do a lot of you know, stuff about, oh, I hate this, I hate that. Best thing, the thing I was most proud of was, I used to be on a website that was called 50 People More Annoying Than Mick Hucknall.
Oh, no!
Yeah, that was great.
Oh.
No, but firstly, can you imagine 50 People More Annoying Than Mick Hucknall? I was like number 20. Now, it's gone completely downhill, because it now exists as 500 people.
Oh, that's nothing. That's not good, is it? That's watering it down.
I thought it was really funny.
For a while, a couple of years ago, you can get this Google alert where you type in you have your name, and every time your name comes up on the internet, you get an email. I did that, and I stopped it after 2 days. Oh God, I wanted to kill myself.
Yeah, no, you don't want to do
Jesus.
That.
Jesus,
insane.
It was horrible. I thought, how did people? What have I done? I did the 11 o'clock show. That's it. Don't hate me for that.
I was talking to Chris Tookie, you know, the film critic of the Daily Mail, about this, and he wrote a review of a film that he didn't like it. I think it was Kick-Ass, and he didn't like it. And he said that he didn't like it, and then people said how much they didn't like him not liking it. And he came into a screening one day and he said, I feel like I'm being cyber bullied.
Mm.
I said, what do you mean? He said, because people are saying really terribly hateful things about me. I said, how do you know? He said, well, I've got a Google alert. I went, well, Chris.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
You know,
Switch that off
and then get on with your life.
Right, listen, let's do the date. So the 4th of November, you're Barrass Bridge. Oh, Newcastle. You're in Newcastle.
Newcastle.
Yes. Monday the 8th of November, you're in Nottingham.
Yes.
Oh, good luck. Friday the 12th.
Why did you say that?
Oh, I don't like Nottingham.
Why?
Or am I thinking of Northampton? No, Nottingham. It's a bit grim, isn't it?
No.
I hosted a KISS convention there once, and I remember walking down the streets, people were going, it's Marlon Dingle from Emmerdale! And I thought, I don't want to be in this place anymore.
Well, I'll tell you what, I did an interview with a radio station up in Nottingham, and we started talking, it was meant to be talking about this thing that I was, the talk that I was doing. We started talking about Russell Crowe's accent in the Robin Hood movie. That was it. 25 minutes later, we stopped talking. I mean, so, you know, I'm fine. I'm
all right, well, then you can enjoy it. You're in Coventry, Liverpool, all the Arts Depot in North Finchley on Friday the 19th.
Yeah, have you been there?
No, I've not been. I live just around the corner in Muswell Hill, so...
Yeah, well, because that's where I used to live, and I'm wondering whether the building that the Arts Depot is in is what used to be the Gaumont Cinema, which is where I saw Alien the first time, to bring it back to something you were talking about earlier.
I can't
on,
think.
In a beautifully cyclical way.
I will pop along and... I will come to that, yes. It's just around the corner. Thank you. And then you're in Manchester as well after that. The book... It's only a movie, and the paperback is out now for those who don't want to carry a big, heavy hardback around.
Who does? And also, it's a nicer pick. I actually prefer the paperback cover. Which one do you like best?
I prefer the chainsaw one.
Fine.
Yeah, sorry.
The classic chainsaw.
And on that bombshell, it's lovely to see you again, Mark. Thank you very much.
And I forgive you for being rude to me, which I don't even remember.
Good.
And God bless you for bringing up Danny Baker After All, which was a lovely TV series.
It was fantastic. I'm going to stop that there.